We welcome you all this morning as we commence our subcommittee meeting.
Tim, I guess.
Trying to decide how technical I need to be. Is this a sub-sub because we don't have a quorum? We'll just begin and we'll have others join us as we go along. Today we get a chance for the overview of Department of Human Services, and we welcome you, Director Weeks and Deputy Director Cindy Becker. Anyone else that's involved? I'll ask Sheila Baker if you have anything for us before we get started.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, I would just note that you have in front of you the Department of Human Services budget bill. This is the budget bill for the whole department. We expect that by the time you get to a work session, there will be significant amendments to that, but that's what their budget looks like. We expect to have about a month worth of hearings on the various pieces of the department in this initial phase one, where we're looking at the program overview, performance priorities, and reduction. So the department will be with us for some time in the subcommittee.
Thank you. Director Weeks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think what Sheila's trying to tell you is you will come to know us better than your family. So, but we appreciate the chance to be here and get started so early, Mr. Chairman. We have before you the materials that we're going to work from, the budget presentation document. It's outlined in the way that the your staff has asked us to in three phases. And so today, in this next 2.5 hours or so, we'll try to cover for the department as a whole things like the historical perspective of the department. And I recognize that for some members this will be old hat, and I ask you your indulgence, and for others maybe it'll be informative to hear more about the history of the department. We're going to go through all a summary, a very high-level summary of programs and services, because you will hear from each cluster drill down in the programs and services as they come behind us, and then we'll talk a little bit about how the agency is organized, discuss our 28 legislatively approved performance measures, and then spend some time on the prioritization list, because your staff has asked us as part of this process to prioritize the entire governor's recommended budget. We've done that. We'll show you how that has worked out, and then we have a list of 10% reductions that we'll go through. So Cindy and I will kind of split this up, and then we'll rely on you to interrupt us when you want us to go a little deeper into something. Let me just very quickly start with the mission and the goals. The department's mission and goals are pretty straightforward. We believe that our role is to try to keep Oregonians as independent and healthy and safe as possible. And that means that we try to design programs to that extent, and when we say as independent as possible, we recognize that many of our clients will not be independent, or their level of independence will be very small. But we still have as a goal that we try to help people live as independently as possible, and that we try to help people support themselves and their families. And we'll talk about that in a variety of different ways. As you have questions throughout our presentation, if we don't have the answers, we're committed, Mr. Chairman, to try to have those answers back to you in 24 hours so that the next day we'll try to have whatever you ask us to. We've developed a budget data book. Cindy and others put a lot of time into this document. We went back and looked at questions that have been asked from prior sessions because we think we can expect some of the similar questions. So we hope we have most of the data that you may ask. But undoubtedly, there will be questions that we haven't anticipated, and we'll get back to them quickly. And I hope I'm not speeding through this too fast, but we've got a lot to cover in 2.5 hours. You can tell me to slow down when you want. I'm going to do that when we get to the org. Let me talk a little bit about the history of the department. This department was created in 1971, and if you were to go back and listen to the floor speeches or read the record, which I did when I took this job first in 1995, all of the reasons for creating this department as it was were the right reasons, because the department brought together what was then Children's Services, Public Welfare, Mental Health, Corrections, Employment, and Voc Rehab. Those were all independent agencies, and they were brought together. And the floor speeches, I think, were right on, at least right on where I believe we have to be, and that was that the reason to do this was to build an integrated system of social supports for people that independently these agencies had historically not been able to build the kind of service integration model that really is what helps people be successful, building programs around them. So all the right thinking and logic to create the department. And then I say this carefully and with respect to the Ways and Means process, but then the bill went to Ways and Means, and in Ways and Means, each division, each of these programs was created as a division with its own budget, its own infrastructure, its own, in some cases, the director of the division confirmation by the Senate, similar to the director. So the right idea was there, but the result was more of an umbrella agency or a confederation, because you then had six divisions all sort of enabled to be small agencies, but under this rubric of the Department of Human Services. And I think for many years, that's why we never got to the goal that so many legislators expressed very articulately, the goal of trying to build a really integrated service system. When I took this job in 95 under John Kitzhaber, Governor John Kitzhaber, we had a long conversation about this history. And I talked with him about, you know, I had served as the deputy director and had watched this for 3 years and then gone away and was coming back, about my belief that the only way you could really accomplish this is to really build an integrated system. And that would mean statutory changes, policy changes, procedure changes within the department to actually begin to get the department to function the way the legislature envisioned it in 1971. And the governor agreed, and that's what we set about doing throughout the mid to late 90s and even today. Now, over time, you all know that some of these agencies that were first part of Human Services were spun off. Employment came off in 1993. Corrections left the department to become its own department in 1987. The Oregon Youth Authority came off in 1996, so all the juvenile corrections was merged with Children's Services when we began, and then it was split in 1996, and you had the OYA. So bits and pieces dropped away from the organization. In 1999, we began really to try to do, along with all the service integration that had gone on, we began to try to look at how to bring all the administrative parts of this agency together, because there had been historically infrastructure around administration for every division, and that was not an easy job. That was a hard job, and it took a lot of effort on many people's parts to take down that independent infrastructure and rebuild what we refer to as a shared services model, which is the kind of model you see at most major companies. So the agency moved its way toward a single personnel operation, a single accounting operation, a single procurement and contracts operation. All of those things which had been individual to every division, we moved to consolidate, and that's where we are today. And you'll hear more about that as we go through this presentation. We also, in that period of the 90s, changed the authority with your help. I had a bill in 1997 and another bill in 1999, which the governor supported and you supported, that began to create this a centralized authority so that the individual division directors were not charged with sort of being able to run their own operation, that there was one director. Because when I took this job, the director of the department actually didn't have the same authority, had less authority than the division administrators did. And so we changed that over time. And another change, which was in one of those bills in 99, was to actually change the name of this agency from the Department of Human Resources to the Department of Human Services. And while that might not seem significant to you, it expressed, I think, what we really wanted for the department, and that was we are not a department of resources. We're a department of services to enable people to live independently, to support their families, to get jobs, to be able to do many things that each of us experience individually. So we made that change. In 2001, House Bill 2294 was a bill that did away with the distinction of the divisions. Divisions were all in statute, so they were actually named in statute, which is a little bit unusual in and of itself. That bill, 2294, did away with the naming of divisions and created what we have today, which are clusters of services. We have a cluster that's the Children and Family Services, we have a cluster that's health, and we have a cluster of seniors and people with disabilities, and then we have an administrative cluster. So we try, and again, this is along the lines of trying to integrate, to move programs together, to get some synergy across purposes, and so that was a fairly significant change that you all approved in 2001. Today, let me briefly tell you, talk a little bit about the programs and services. The Children and Families is the cluster where we have our welfare program that people generally refer to now as the TANF program. TANF is Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. And we will do our best throughout these presentations not to use acronyms without identifying what they are and stay away from them. But the Temporary Assistance to Needy Families is the federal program that provides cash assistance to low-income families. It provides food stamps. It provides job assistance search, child care services, mentoring, job training. Oregon has, over the last few years since TANF begun, developed a pretty good reputation for running a good, strong jobs program here in this state, being able to employ people and move them off of welfare. CAF, Children and Families Cluster, also includes all the programs that relate to child... I'm sorry. Did you want me... You want me to stop, Senator?
Somebody behind you.
Okay.
We continue.
Okay.
He has to make a grand entrance and a grand departure.
Okay.
Senator Ben
Westland. Sorry. I saw the hand wave and I...
We are unworthy. We are unworthy. Please move.
Why don't we continue? We'll catch him up later.
Thank you, Senator. I was saying that in the Children and Families program are all the child welfare programs, child protective services programs, child abuse services, adoption services, all the foster care and substitute care for children who have to be removed from their family for some period of time, and then adoption and permanent planning for children who are unable to go back to their birth families. We also have in this cluster our vocational rehabilitation program, which is aimed at providing training and other supports for people with disabilities in this state in an effort to get them to an employable position. I might add here, Oregon's done some real creative things with its VR program and its training of people with disabilities. We were the first state to get a state plan amendment that allowed people with disabilities to go to work and not lose their supports, their medical supports, their attendant care supports. Because before we came forward with our first request as a plan amendment, if you were a person with a disability and you went to work, you lost attendant, the opportunity for many of your attendant care. You lost your medical and stuff, which, of course, caused most people with disabilities who, in fact, were employable, were skilled, were able to contribute, to not go to work. So we've had a lot of success, and you'll hear more about that when you get into the VR program, with putting people to work in the state who have disabilities. The health services cluster, the second cluster, is three offices. It's the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, which is where we house the Oregon Health Plan, and the Office of Public Health. Public Health, when the agency in 2001 and 2002 began to develop into these clusters, we really lost a public health office, because prior to that we had a public health division. And when I came back to this job, Cindy and I both came back to this job, one of the real cries that I heard from local officials was for some way to reinstate an Office of Public Health. We didn't lose the functions of public health, epidemiology, vital statistics, the lab, so on like that, but there was no place when we dissolved the public health office to actually go to. There was no there. You know, so if someone had a question, they had to know where to find the right person within the health cluster. And I've worked a lot over the last few months with the Council of Local Health Officials, which is the County Local Health Officials, and AOC, to try to redesign a public health focus that everyone would feel more comfortable with. I mean, some of your members, and you may know who they are, have been equally frustrated that we didn't have the public health focus. And recently, I hired a new public health director. We used a position that we felt that we didn't need and carved that off, and I hired a woman by the name of Dr. Susan Allen, who's from Virginia, who is a very talented public health director. She's probably the only public health director in America, county public health person, who has lived through three major crises. She was responsible for public health in Virginia when 9/11 occurred, and there was the disaster in Washington, D.C., which spilled over into her county in Virginia. She was in Virginia responsible for the reactions to the sniper attacks and to the anthrax attacks. So this is a person who's had a lot of experience with bioterrorism and is a national leader in public health. I'm very excited that we were able to get her here. She will be here in March, and we will introduce her to you as soon as we have the opportunity. And she will lead a clearly defined public health group and a public health initiative. So that's, you know, public health is an area where we did this little paper once to try to describe for people back in the late 90s all the impacts of public health. And we started by saying, you know, it's sort of a scenario that when you get up in the morning, public health is there when you turn on your water and brush your teeth, when you stop and get your bagel and coffee, you know, when you're interacting with other people who may have infectious diseases, when you call and want a birth certificate for your son or daughter to play sports or something like that. Public health is intertwined throughout all of our lives. They are an important mission for us. The other two parts of the health service, Office of Mental Health and Addictions, of course, deals with all of our mental health services that are largely community-based. It involves the operation of our state hospitals, the largest one being here in Salem, and the other two being smaller operations in Portland and out in Pendleton. We have alcohol and drug prevention and treatment programs, which we'll tell you more about as we go through this. So OMHAS is Mental Health and Addiction Services is a critical support for the other clusters, for welfare, for job placement, for child abuse, for reunification of children and families. Mental Health and Addiction Services is so critical to our outcomes in those other clusters. And then the third piece of health services is the health plan, the largest single expenditure that we have in this department and one of the largest single expenditures that you have in state government. And it impacts about 380,000 people who are now on the health plan. And I think most of you know that we have a couple of different flavors of the health plan. We have OHP Plus, which is our program that's dedicated to low-income seniors, people with disability, parents and children that are low-income, pregnant women. All of those are what are described as categorically eligible for OHP Plus. Children who come from families that are not eligible for OHP Plus, they're above the Medicaid limits, are served in part through the Children's Health Insurance Program, which, again, I know many of you are very familiar with. And then the second general part of the health plan is what we call OHP Standard, which is a limited benefit for individuals that earn at or less than 100% of the federal poverty level. We had a lot of discussion about this plan during the interim because we were struggling to, some of you know that because you served on the emergency board, but we were struggling to put together a tax revenue source for the standard population, and that tax revenue source had to be supported and endorsed by those who were the payees, and in this case, managed care organizations and hospitals. And then we had a long discussion with CMS to get approval from the feds to use those tax revenues as matching monies for federal dollars. But it all worked out, and we now have the standard plan supported by taxes from MCOs and the hospitals. And the combination of the taxes and the matching funds enable us to support about 24,000 people It's dramatically down from where we were at one time. There were 100,000 people at one time receiving these kinds of benefits. We're now down to about 24,000, and that's where we have to be by the end of the biennium. That's the target that's in the governor's budget, is that we stay at about that level. So we have about 380,000 people in the regular health plan, OHP Plus. We have about 24,000 in the standard plan, and that's what we're looking at going into the next biennium. So those are the three parts of what we call the health cluster. And then the third cluster of programs is for seniors and people with disability. We have a major partner in this, and it's local government. It's the AAAs and the counties who are major partners for us in the delivery of these programs for seniors and people with disabilities. And we do everything from, with the help of the local organizations, we do everything from the investigation and prevention of abuse against people that are disabled and or seniors, and helping people, seniors and people with disabilities arrange for paying for their in-home care, and trying to help them live independently. We have substitute care for seniors and people with disabilities who can't live in their own homes. Oregon has, as again many of you know, a long history of having a continuum of care, long-term care, for people in the state. We were the first state in 1981 to get a waiver that permitted us to use our Medicaid funds for other than nursing homes. And so over the last nearly 25 years, we have established this continuum of care that's made up of adult foster homes, assisted living homes, residential care facilities, and nursing homes. And so there are great choice and great opportunity within the system that we run now, and for years it's been the envy of a lot of other states. And many states continue to struggle with systems that largely rely on nursing homes. In our case, only about 15% of our people in long-term care are in nursing homes. The bulk are in some of these other levels of care. One of the challenges that we'll be able to talk with you more about as we get into phase two are really the demographic challenges of an aging population here in Oregon as well as elsewhere. But we are going to be faced with more and more folks aging out. I'm on the front end of this. So these are going to be my people down the road, and I have a particular interest in these programs and so on. But as you will see in the governor's budget when we get to that phase, there are efforts being made in the governor's recommended budget to try to figure out how to box this problem a little bit. Because if left unattended, we will find ourselves in two or three biennia where so much of your resource is going to be committed to this long-term care for both seniors and people with disabilities that will drain almost anything else that we may be able to do for children and other kinds of programs. So that's just to let you know that this is one of the more important public policy questions, I think, in this budget discussion for you this biennium is around what we do with people with disabilities and seniors.
I'd like to ask a question.
Yes, sir.
In the State of the Union address last night by the President, he referred to reductions that may be made, or at least implied that there will be certain reductions from a federal level on programs for entitlements and so forth. Has your office received any indication as to what the federal government might be looking at and how that would affect us?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we haven't specifically. I mean, we respond to inquiries from our delegation frequently where they will ask us, well, what if the Medicaid program was cut by this? What's the impact? But I know there has been some conversation in Washington that the Medicaid program, it could be cut by as much as $100 billion. If it were cut by $100 billion, we did a little work on this because we had heard that as a possibility. It would mean that close to half our hospitals might close. Half of our long-term care system probably would not be able to survive. It would have devastating effect on our ability to provide services for seniors and for people with disabilities. So, you know, our great hope is that that won't happen. And that's obviously going to be a consideration, or a concern, I should say, for virtually every governor in this country. Because in every state, and I had the opportunity to work in many other states, the Medicaid expense, the health expense, is the largest behind the schools expense of all state governments. So while I think it certainly we have to look at how to contain these costs, and that's what I'm saying to you is the real public policy question is how do we contain these costs? My hope would be that we don't act in a way that really devastates our programs and leaves us open to other problems.
I can just see as we're looking at this box based on the demographics of our state that the federal government's got to be doing the same thing. Certainly they're looking at Social Security, so you know that they're looking at what the national demographics will be as with an aging population and how that will affect the cost of Medicare and all these other things that affect our citizens. So it's going to be incredibly important, the decisions that they make there, how the effect that that will have on us.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. Chair.
Senator Bates.
And Gary, you may want to comment to this. Oregon and some other states are in a position in their long-term care and in their health care costs that we have been very efficient in comparison to other states, extremely efficient, so that we're in a position that if they cut equally across all the states, we start dropping people out. Other states have been rewarded for their inefficiency with higher and higher rates, especially Medicare, somewhat in long-term care. And I think states like Oregon are very vulnerable to sudden changes at the federal level as far as our funding is concerned. And that's something we have to watch carefully. If the president and the administration really want to make cuts and do it in a reasonable fashion, there are states that should be hit harder and others less. But at this point, over the last 15 or 20 years, basically the states that have been efficient have been punished for it, and the states that have been prolific have been rewarded. And that's part of the policy has to change. I had a discussion with the former director of CMS 2 years ago about that in an open meeting, and he just backed away from it. He knows it's a problem at that time, but wasn't willing to deal with it. Tommy Thompson's gone, and new people are in, and I'm not sure what their position is anymore. But your point is well taken, especially for this state. We are more vulnerable than other states because of our efficiencies.
Now, Mr. Chairman, Senator Bates is right on the mark. This sort of comes under the category of no good deed goes unpunished. You know, the more we've really worked to try to reduce our costs. I mean, we have 71% or 72%, I think, are covered by managed care. Barney Spade can give you the details of that better than I. So we've worked to get a lot of people under managed care to help reduce our costs. We've worked in ways to try to manage our pharmaceutical costs. And all of this over the years has in some ways resulted in us drawing down less federal funds because for those states that where the cost is higher, they may actually achieve a higher rate of reimbursement than we achieve as a result of being much more thoughtful, much more careful. And that's something that as the Medicaid program of the future is looked at, hopefully we'll be able to weigh in on that in the way that I think Senator Bates is suggesting, that those states that really are working to try to manage these costs, there's a benefit to their work. So let's see, let me move on and just talk for a minute about the department-wide support services, because we've gone through very briefly on the three clusters, and my intent was to give you just a 10,000-foot view, because we'll drill down into these as we get further along. Department-wide services is what supports the department. It is our shared services model. It's where all of the services for administration and finance and policy are. And maybe if I could, Mr. Chairman, direct you all to page 9 of the book. There's an organization chart there, and I want to just take 4 or 5 minutes and talk from that. And at this point, I'd like to also ask the committee's indulgence for me to introduce the leadership of the department who are with me here today. We're going to try not to congregate here frequently. We all have work to do, and I've been aware of, I've learned my lesson over the years about how it's not helpful to have a whole lot of people in the room. So, but I thought on this first day it was important to introduce you to some folks. I'm going to start with Barry Cast, and I don't know. Barry is the assistant director for all of the health services area. Many of you know and have worked with Barry. Ramona Foley is here, who is in charge of the Children and Families Cluster. Her deputy is Jim Mealy, and Jim has been around a long time, and many of you have had a chance to work with him. James Taves is the Assistant Director for Seniors and People with Disabilities. Behind me, one of our newest staff is Barney Spate. Looks like my smarter brother. and with him is Lynn Reed, who has worked in the Office of Health Policy for many, many years. Mm-hmm. Clyde Psyche, Clyde is the person who's our administrative officer. Clyde runs administrative services. Dick Todd is our finance and policy person in charge of the budget. And Cindy Becker is with me, and I think.
Cindy generally needs no introduction, so I'm.
Oh, she can speak for herself. Having introduced these, let me just run through some of the functions that are out of the director's office, because it's important, I think, for you to know what we've put in the director's office. Auditing and consulting. We have six internal auditors. When I started with this department, we had one internal auditor for the largest agency in government. Over time, the legislature has supported us and given us more internal auditors. I place a high value on these folks. When I came back with the governor's election to DAS, I began the first statewide audit committee, and the first requirement for all agencies of a certain size to have an internal audit function. These internal auditors report only to Cindy and I. We at the beginning of each year, we go through a list of risks in the department. We do a risk analysis, and then we make a decision as to how we're going to use the internal auditor's time, much like a private business does. They set up an internal audit plan based on the risks, and they follow the audit plan throughout the year, and those six people get a great deal of work done. That audit and consulting group also includes five Medicaid auditors that we have had for several years, and another five that the emergency board approved for us to start in January. But just to give you a sense of what these Medicaid auditors can accomplish, and in the last calendar year, 2004, they returned $1.7 million of recoveries, those five auditors did. So they averaged about $340,000 apiece in recovery, which is why I believe the emergency board approved our request to put another group on and start them before the start of the next biennium. And the kinds of things that those Medicaid auditors are looking at are they review all durable medical expenditures to try to determine whether they were provided with a legitimate physician's order, and sometimes they're not. They look to see whether the client's medical conditions were appropriately reported or whether they were miscoded in some way. They look at whether pharmaceuticals are being provided without appropriate physician's order. They look at all the billing codes, and that analysis goes on all the time of all the bills coming in from all sorts of providers. And when we find that we've been overbilled or we've overpaid, that's where the $1.7 million comes from in the last calendar year, is recovery on those kinds of overpayments. The Governor's Advocacy Office, which is the second thing in that box very quickly, may be the part of my office that some of you have used the most. Legislators routinely call the Governor's Advocacy Office. That is a group of people. They take 150 to 200 calls a day. They get over 200 emails a day. And they are looking at your constituency problems, your constituency questions. If somebody calls in and says, you know, I should have been provided with this kind of aid and so on. They have access to all records in the department. They're the only part of the department that has access to all records. They are independent to the extent that they only report to me through Cindy, which gives them the ability to really go in and delve into, you know, actions that we have may have taken, behaviors that we have done, you know, really gives them the chance to advocate on behalf of the public. The third position there, tribal liaison, one of the most important relationships we have as an agency is with the nine tribes of Oregon. We work very hard on this relationship because the tribes have accepted differing levels of responsibility. Some of the tribes run their own child welfare programs, and so we relate to them because they are a sovereign nation. We have a special relationship to them in child welfare. A couple of the tribes actually run their own TANF program, their own jobs program, and so on, and so we are a partner with them in that. But I meet, along with our staff, every quarter with all the nine tribes. Together, we have a quarterly meeting to review what's going on with the tribes, and then I personally try to visit with every tribal council at least once a year across the state. So this is an important relationship that we have. And I guess the last area, the one that I feel most excited about, is the business process improvement. You won't see this in any of the material for the current biennium because we started this after the biennium began. Cindy was on the forefront of putting this together when we were at DAS, and when we came to DHS, we said there are lots of opportunities here in DHS for business reengineering and process improvement. I want to just give you a couple of examples that have happened just within the last few months. And we do this with one staff. We have one person and one contract person who's a private sector person that's done a lot of business processing work. But by way of example of what can happen if you really focus on your reengineering opportunities and your business processing opportunities, out at our processing center for the OHP processing center where they handle application forms from all across the state, our processing time when we started looking at how we could improve was 26 days. Took us 26 days to process an application. We were paying $27,000 every month for overtime to get a 26-day turnaround time. We took our staff, a group of staff, about 12 people, isolated for 3 days with our business process leaders, and from that three-day retreat and changes that we made today, we process those in 3 days. 3 days from the time the application comes in till the day that we send the notice out to the client. So we went from 26 days to 3 days, and the savings over the biennium is $2.6 million. Savings in overtime and so on. That's one example. And we have others in our criminal records checks where we have dramatically changed the criminal record check process, and we do 14,000 a month. We do 14,000 criminal record checks a month. We now are able to do this in just a couple of weeks when we were taking 6 to 8 weeks to do criminal records checks. The impact of 6 to 8 weeks is that nobody can hire in a community setting anybody to do our work without a criminal records check, which means that if you're a nonprofit working for us or a county government working for us and you're out trying to find somebody to work at what's not really good wages anyway and you get them, it's in the past it's taken us 6 to 8 weeks to get that person through. So you had to hang on to that potential worker, and it was just killing us in terms of being able to do business. So these are fairly immediate things that can be done if you look at how you re-engineer the work that you're doing, and so we are going to continue to devote whatever resource we can to this business process reengineering. And the last thing I want to say about this chart has to do with the volunteer program, which isn't printed on here anywhere. And some of you have been in the legislature for a while, have worked with our volunteers. We have close to 1,800 volunteers that work all over Oregon. They provide 450,000 hours of volunteer service in every corner of this state, and they do mentoring with kids, they do literacy tutoring, they are drivers, dispatchers, driver's assistants, caseload assistants, they do virtually everything you can think of. They are quilters, they quilt blankets for children that we're having to take into foster care, so these kids when they leave their home they get a blanket to take with them. But these are very valuable people for us. They don't frequently get recognized, and so while we didn't name them on the chart, I want you to know that there are a lot of folks throughout the state that are contributing many of their own hours to help us be successful. Okay, so with that, we're going to go into perform. You're going to use the slides.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we have a few slides. We'll hit them very quickly for you to give you some sort of background before we move into the next section. Cindy.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Cindy Becker. I'm the Deputy Director for the Department of Human Services. And your ABLE assistant, I think, is going to be handing out copies of the PowerPoint slides. The purpose of these slides is to give you the 10, 20, 30,000 foot view of the agency. It's really to set the context for what you're going to be hearing over the next 4 weeks. And I'll just wait until she gets those done. You'll notice that your copies are in black and white. We hope that's okay.
Efficiency.
Efficiency. We're very careful about this, Mr. Chairman. So.
Okay, where's the... What's going on here? There we go. The first slide speaks to where we get our money. In terms of the department's budget for 0507, we, in the governor's budget, it's $9.567 billion. And of those dollars, 62% of them come from federal funds, 25% are general funds, and 12.4% are other funds, of which 7.8 million of the 1.2 billion is from lottery funds. I need to understand what's going on here. What the next slide talks about are the federal funds that we get. It takes that 62% of federal funds that you saw in the previous slide and gives you information about where those federal fund sources come from. And these are just the major federal funds. There's, as you can see, 11% in other, and we get federal funds from multiple sources. But as Gary mentioned earlier, 66% of our federal funds are, in fact, Medicaid dollars. The next slide talks about the $2.4 billion of general funds, and it gives you an idea of how those general funds are used. As you can see from the slide, only 13% of our general funds are not matched somewhere. The majority of our general funds are used to match Medicaid dollars. There's also 2% in food stamps, and that's for the staffing costs, the maintenance of effort dollars with TANF, temporary assistance for needy families, and then we have some matching dollars with other federal funds. But a small portion of our dollars are just pure general fund programs, and those go for such things as Oregon State Hospital funding, as well as a variety of child welfare programs. In the next slide, what we tried to show you here is how our dollars, the $9.5 billion total funds, are spread across the agency by cluster. Only 4.3% of our dollars are used for department-wide support services, otherwise known as administrative or business services. Again, the majority of our dollars are in health services and for people with seniors and people with disabilities. If you look at those two alone, those are 72% of our total fund dollars. The next slide shows a similar proportionality for how we use our general fund dollars. Again, with here 78% of our general funds going to health services and seniors and people with disabilities. The next chart tries to show you how our services are broken out by a different array. And I think the important point here is 79% of our dollars go out the door. They go out the door in client benefits and services. They go out the door to local communities, to local governments, directly to clients in the way of benefits, also directly to providers. And here only 4.3% of our dollars, again, are in department-wide support services. The field services are those services that directly work with our clients. We have 150 different field offices. These are our caseworkers. They're working in a variety of different areas. The state-operated services include the state hospitals, Eastern Oregon Training Center, our state-operated group homes. And then the 4% of population-based services are focused on the public health dollars. So it's really important, we think, that people understand that the majority of our funds go out the door to local communities. Anybody have any questions? Okay. We're next going to talk about the people that we serve. And we're not going to give you information about every single caseload and every single population that we serve, but we think it's important for you to have an understanding of the agency to understand the wide diversity of the services and the people whom we serve, as well as what has happened with those caseloads over time. What we're going to show you the next few slides really deals with the Oregon Health Plan population. And you can see the first slide speaks to Oregon Health, the plus population, and what has happened since 1999 and the increase in that population. The next shows standard, and I know Senator Bates has talked about this quite a few times, that the significant drop in the standard population. You can see in 2002, there was over 100,000 people provided services through standard, and we're now looking at less than 50,000, and as Gary mentioned earlier, going down to 24,000. Those people still live here. They're still in Oregon. They are showing up in other parts of the system, and as Senator Bates has said, primarily in hospital emergency rooms. Next is the CHIP program. That's the Children's Insurance Program. You can see that program is slightly increasing. You'll hear more about this when Barney and Lynn talk about the program and some of the outreach efforts that we have undertaken and some of the pilot programs that have started this biennium. The next is the Breast and Cervical Cancer Program. That program was started in 2002. It is obviously a significant rise, but if you look on the left, your axis, the numbers clearly are very small. This next slide goes to what Gary talked about a little earlier. While it doesn't talk about people, it does speak to the claims that we receive. And I think the really important point is to look at 1995 to 97, where we were getting 21 million claims during that year. We had 188 staff processing those claims. 10 years later, we have less staff, 167 staff, processing 2.5 times the number of claims from 10 years ago. That's 51.9 million. One of the questions we're hoping you'll ask is, well, how did that happen? Okay, we'll give you the answer. Thank you, Gary. How it happened is through business process reengineering and technology, looking at different ways that we do our business and applying technology. I can tell you one of the issues for us is we would really like to see that $51.9 million. These are paper claims that come in the door. We can do this electronically. We are starting to do this electronically. It will make the numbers go down dramatically if our providers start submitting electronically. It'll make our costs go down dramatically, and they'll get paid quicker. So we are really hoping that our providers, and these are all different medical types of providers, really start stepping up to using electronic submissions. And I know that the Senator Moniz Anderson is going to talk about that in her committee as well.
Cindy, is there any information on how we compare? I mean, essentially, this is a state-run insurance company. And so how do we compare with Blue Cross Blue Shield or other companies that have large volumes as far as claims per claims adjuster?
Mr. Chair, we can get that information. Barney and Lynn, when they come up, we're talking about OMAP, can provide that information for you.
But that's an important question, Mr. Chairman, because we're trying to hold ourselves to similar kinds of standards. We run probably the largest insurance company in the state, and we think we should be able to get to the kind of standards that are in the private sector once we develop the same kind of tools they have. I mean, they wouldn't paper process stuff the way we do. And so we have to find a way. What Cindy's is really saying to you in a kinder, gentler way is we have to find a way to really force more of the providers to give us stuff electronically, which in turn means we can make payments faster and cheaper. Mm-hmm. Right now, they're not doing that. So,
okay, Mr. Chair. Representative Hannah first, and then Senator Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, we're hoping they file electronically, but what's the incentive or what's the program to get them turned over to filing electronically?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hannah, I think I think part of the program is education, information, understanding that if they will, on their end, find ways to do that, because there's some technology things they have to do. They can get their money sooner. They can get payments sooner. And I think both Barney and Lynn can probably talk with you in more detail. But, I mean, from my view, there's a lot of education involved here and information. And some may never want to go away from paper. But I think the more that we can convince that it's better for them, it's not just about being better for us. We have to sell this as the as a benefit to providers.
Incentives for them.
Ms. Chatto, I don't really want to go into at this point in these kind of questions, but it is interesting and good information, so I don't want to tie things up too long, but I'm going to ask a couple of questions real quickly.
Sure.
And if you, and I don't expect an answer necessarily right now, but you can get back to me later. There are barriers, I believe, to electronic billing from the provider's point of view. First, I think we're talking about fee-for-service primarily in hospital services that we're talking about here.
Yes.
Because the managed care plans take care of this themselves, right? Do they present any billing issues for you at all?
Not, Barney? Do
that
they present
part,
billing
need
issues?
Get more detail.
Your encounter claims or encounter data is submitted by
the But that's it, the encounter data. Yeah. Okay.
They confront claims processing issues on paper like
The barriers to physicians' offices are supplying a system at their end that can electronically bill, which is a very expensive process. The other part of it is getting a federal ID number, and the other part of that is getting that federal ID number to you in a way that you can process it and get it back to the physicians. And I'm assuming that's the case. I've just gone through this myself. It takes months to get that through the system, not just for you, but for the other insurers, too. There are significant barriers still. Once you get it set up, it seems to function very well, very efficiently for both sides. But the barriers appear to be initial setups, initially how you handle those, how you transfer from a paper system to an electronic system and that interface in between, and the cost of doing that at the physician's end. And I'm assuming for hospitals, they probably most hospitals are already on electronic systems, so it's a little simpler for them. But you're talking about fee-for-service providers,
yes.
Primarily physicians, right?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'm Senator Bates. The other issue, and to your discussion, we do have staff that are willing to go out and work with providers and help them, and so it's not just us sitting here saying you've got to do this and to work through some of the issues. The other thing, quite honestly, is we know that some providers don't want to go electronic because once you go electronic, you have to comply with HIPAA, which is Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. And with HIPAA comes a lot more than electronic billing. There's a lot of issues around security and privacy, confidentiality of information. There's probably a 2-inch thick regulations you have to comply with. And so I think that is been part of the issue with providers. As long as you don't bill electronically, you don't have to comply with HIPAA.
Okay.
The barriers are significant, and I just ran it through my office without saying that I'm a senator up here to see how it went. We haven't got it yet. We've been trying for 3 months to get on to electronic billing. Now, I don't want this to go back to the department on me personally, okay? But that shows you the barriers.
Yeah.
Okay. They're huge, and so it's difficult. Okay?
Thank you. The next, we're going to leave the Oregon Health Plan. As soon as I can get this done. There we go. And talk a little bit about some of the caseloads of people that we're serving in the area of mental health services. You can see what's happened over time over the past 10 years, serving the number of children and the number of adults, and how those recently those numbers, at least for adults, have decreased, again, as a result of a variety of budget actions. The next chart talks about the number of people receiving substance abuse services. And what I want you to see is not only the trends, but the more important is the numbers of people that we're serving across the state in a variety of different services. Again, this is broken out by children and adults. We're going to change to TANF, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. The caseloads here have significantly dropped over the past 10 years. That was by design. That was not just a reflection of budget cuts, but this was really significant effort to move people off of TANF, off of welfare, into jobs. And Ramona and Jim Neely are going to talk a lot more with you about that, and they're going to talk about the performance measures, but we've had a lot of successes in TANF. The opposite has happened in the food stamp caseload, and we know that this has a lot to do with the economy. You can see the past 4 years what has happened to food stamps. A lot of this has to do with the outreach efforts. We are pleased to say that we actually just got a $2 million award from the federal government because we are the third highest state in food stamp outreach. So we've been very successful in making sure that we're getting food stamps to individuals who need them. The next several slides speak to the issue that Gary was talking around, the aging of Oregonians. This first slide just talks about the entire population, and over the, from 2000 to 2020, where you see that our population will be increasing to close to 4.25 million. Mm-hmm. The next population shows you, if you look at that other graph, what's going to happen to the population of Oregon for people who are 65 and older. Significant difference in that trend line. And the last slide here shows you what's happening to people who are 85 years and older. Not as steep a curve, but also we're seeing that increase. People who are older are living longer.
That also assumes that there's no breakthroughs in medical research and so forth.
That would make sense.
You have to think about that for just a moment.
Okay, all right. That was like really stupid. Okay, yeah. Thank you very much, Senator Bates, for pointing that out. I'm sorry, did somebody have a question?
Nice. You were born at a very young age as well.
That's right. Okay, this is great. Famous quotes in Ways and Means.
But
thank you.
Yogi Bear thing, we understand what you're trying to say.
Okay, may I proceed?
Absolutely. You're the star today.
The next slide shows you what has happened with that trend actually since 1900. So this isn't a new phenomenon in this century. But you can see what's happening, that the population 65 and older is growing as a proportion of the entire population, that the children's population is shrinking, and so this just takes you back 100 years to see what's gone on in this trend. And those people are still getting older. Okay. What the next charts speak to is the types of services that we provide for seniors and people with disabilities. This first chart talks about the in-home services, and as Gary said, we are a leader in the nation in providing alternatives to nursing facility services. The number of in-home and community-based services that we provide as a percentage of services is significantly different and is significantly higher than other states. I want to say that I was also one of the authors in 1981 of the Home and Community-Based Waiver, so that shows you how old I am. The next slide talks about the community service for seniors and people with disabilities. These are services in adult foster homes and residential care facilities and assisted living facilities. And also you can see the difference here in the nursing facility caseload. If we went back to 1981, you would see that trend even higher. And we have continued to decrease, although that decrease, and I know James is going to talk about that when he gets up about seniors and people with disabilities, the nursing facility caseload is not declining as fast as we had thought it would, but it is, in fact, leveling off to a certain extent. The next chart talks about the services that we provide for people with developmental disabilities, and you can see the broad range of services. And again, if we went back several years, you would see the large number of people that were in Fairview Training Center and Eastern Oregon Training Center. We are pleased to say that in terms of institutional services, we have Eastern Oregon Training Center, which I think has a population of about 40 individuals, which is significantly different from the thousands and thousands of people that were in institutions in the 1900s.
Do you know approximately how many clients we have at the Oregon State Hospital?
Barry's going to talk about that. The current census today is 750? About 750 individuals.
Thank you.
The one slide that I'm sorry I didn't put up here, we have a variety of slides around child welfare services, and I know Ramona and Jim are going to go through those in terms of foster care and other substitute care services that we provide. With that, that's the end of the presentation. Any questions?
Any members, any questions? Thank you very much. I appreciate the overview. We are anxious to get into the details.
Well, that's not the end of
We're
the
not
whole
done
presentation.
Yet. I'm just done with that part. I have other things to say.
I'll be right back.
Oh, you're missing the best part.
We're going to move on to a conversation about our performance measures. And there are 28. Cindy's going to lead us through some brief discussion about those.
Thank you. And again, if your sister Kathy is going to give some information, we're going to talk about performance measures, about how we got to where we are with performance measures. We're going to give you a high-level overview on the measures. But I think what's the most telling about our measures is the information that's being handed out right now. One of the things that we started this year is a public education initiative called Making a Difference. We can talk about percentages and we can talk about all these really cool measures, but unless we're making a difference for individuals, for communities, and the economy, all these that people can see and feel and touch, that the percentages don't mean a lot to them. We do make significant difference in people's lives, and what we're in the process of doing is letting you know, letting our constituents know how that actually happens. What you're handed is the Making a Difference profiles of various counties that talk about the type of services we provide, the results of those services, what happens for individuals, and the types of services, what happens in counties around wellness, the public health services, and the economy. As I mentioned earlier in the slide, 79% of our dollars go out the door. We are a significant economic engine, an economic driver in many small communities, from the food stamp programs to the health services programs to the employment programs. The Department of Human Services, and these are not Department of Human Services staff. These are local people. These are your providers. These are your county staff. And these are individuals employed as a result of the services that we're able to get out the door and send to them locally. So we just wanted you to have this because I think this really touches what you're all about. This is about your constituents and your communities. Now I'm going to talk about the larger performance measures. You've heard, I think, from other people. I think you've heard from Mickey Lansing as well in the past couple of days about the performance measures. They're really a system to look at accountability. They're a tool for decision making, and they're a tool for accountability. All of our performance measures, the 28 of them, really relate to the four department goals that Gary talked about earlier, people living as independently as possible, people are able to support themselves and their families, people are safe, and people are healthy. In your appendix is the full chart of all of the 28 measures that the agency has. If you might ask the question, why do you have 28 measures? The reason for that is when the measure started in 2001, really when this whole statewide initiative started, no agency was allowed to have more than 30 measures, which with an agency our size was tough. And we have over 200 different types of programs. We have a variety of different populations. But we did try to limit, well, we had to limit our measures to 30. And we tried to select those measures that were not only critical to the heart of the agency, but were indicators of other things happening. So if you look at wellness in the communities, there's a couple of indicators here that will tell you about that. So you don't have to measure every single program, but if you measure a few of those indicators, that will help. I started out my career in the area of developmental disabilities, and one of the things that we looked at, we used to measure everything. We'd say, can the person dress themselves? Can they do their hair? Can they toilet? Can they eat? And really what we found is if somebody can dress themselves, that means they have the skills to do a variety of other activities, so in fact you don't have to measure every single activity. And that's what these measures are. These are indicators of broader initiatives and broader results for the agency. One of the things I also want to mention is our measures don't speak, you won't find administrative measures. You won't find measures that reflect administrative efficiencies. And that's because those were part of the instructions. When the state really undertook the whole area of performance measures, they were focused on programs and services. They were not focused on administrative measures. But when Gary and I were over at DAS and something that we were continuing here, we are developing administrative measures. We think it's important to look at such things as cycle time. How long does it take to get somebody hired? How long does it take to pay a provider? What is our uptime for technology in terms of our systems being up? So we are in the process of developing administrative measures that look at effectiveness and efficiency of our business functions. You won't find that here, but that's something that we're working on. When each cluster does come forward, they are going to talk in a lot of detail about the measures. What we're going to do here is really give you an overview. The other thing that a couple of limitations of the measure that I think were important. Development of the measures is an art as opposed to a science. I can tell you now that while we did make a really good effort to make these measures as reflective of the department as possible, some of them are there because we had data. So we thought, well, we'll just put those, the ones that we have some data to support. We need to refine those over time. I also can tell you that one of the limitations of the measures is we can't change our measures. We can't change anything about our measures unless we come back to you during e-board, during legislative session. That's a limitation because sometimes measures or targets can lay there for several months. We know that we can change them. We know that they should be changed, but we have to wait until we come back to the legislature. One of the ones that was kind of interesting was teen pregnancy prevention. We were more than meeting our target. We were exceeding the target for reduction in teen pregnancy. But if you looked at our charts, our target, we would have to get a lot more teenagers pregnant to meet the target in the subsequent year because we didn't have a chance to change the target to reflect the fact that we had really exceeded reducing that number. Does that make sense?
Yeah, was there a fiscal on that?
A big one. We'll talk about that later. But you could, so sometimes the process doesn't keep up with the information. And we'd certainly like to have the opportunity by the time we were done in June to talk with you about these measures, to talk with you more about some of the ones that may, in fact, be more meaningful than the ones we have, and to talk about a process that might make more sense for all of us. The other thing that we are in the process of doing is we're going to be developing and collecting customer satisfaction measures. Again, as part of effectiveness is how are your customers receiving your services? Are they satisfied with your services? So we are in the process of developing those measures, and we'll be sending those out to our customers and collecting that data. Our customers meaning the people that we serve. What I'm going to do, and you can look at the information. I'm not going to go through all of this detail. It's an extraordinary amount of detail. Instead, what I like to do is just kind of highlight some of the information. You are going to get a lot more detail when each of the clusters come forward. Clearly, we have met some of our targets, and we haven't met others. We can tell you that some of the reasons, particularly the employment-related targets, we are no different than the economy in that respect. When the economy is in financial trouble, when jobs are not for the taking, it affects our clients as well. It affects our ability to move people from TANF. It affects our ability to employ people with disabilities. If the economy isn't robust, then we can't make the types of placements that we had. And that is reflected. But if I'm just going to briefly touch some of the clusters and some of the measures. Please interrupt me if you have questions. The first few measures speak to the ability for people to live in their own homes. We're very successful, as I mentioned earlier, around people, individuals with developmental disabilities, as well as seniors and people with physical disabilities, to live in home and community-based settings. One of the goals years ago, probably 10 years ago, was moving people from not only institutions. Initially, it was moving people to group homes, then moving people to settings that were five or fewer. And really, what we're talking about now for individuals with developmental disabilities is how do you individualize those services? There's no magic number, whether it's 1,000 or 10 or 5. If we want to get help people to live as independently as possible, if that's with their families, if that's with communities, if that's in an apartment, that we're not stamping out cookie-cutter programs for people with disabilities, either physical disabilities or developmental disabilities, and our measures really reflect that. You also look at their key performance measures. That's one of the things I also want to talk to you about. What you'll hear are the term key performance measures, and that's what came out of the Progress Board. I think you got some information from the Progress Board. The key performance measures are very high-level measures. Many of them are driven from the benchmarks. And in many cases, because they're such high-level measures, they're not as meaningful to the line staff, to the people out in the field, to the people who are working these programs. So what you're going to hear when the clusters come forward to you is they're going to talk about the key performance measures, but as important and sometimes more important, they're going to talk about outcome measures that are much closer to the program. They're going to talk about outcome measures that they use on a daily basis. And many of them feed into the key performance measures that feed into the benchmarks. So these are really high-level measures that if you ask a line worker, they're going to say, well, I don't know that measure, but here are the ones that I do know. So what we're talking about here in the overview are those key performance measures. The next measures talk about the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation Services, and as I mentioned earlier, we in fact have not met the target, and we do believe it is reflective of the downturn in the economy. One of the measures in terms of TANF, which is Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, is one of the measures that we use for success of that program is whether or not people are off cash assistance 18 months after they've exited and moved to employment. The goal for this measure is 92% of adults exiting due to employment. In the quarter ending June 2004, the actual performance was 91.5%. And what we're talking about here are jobs where people are moving off cash assistance. So they're working 30 hours or more a week. So while we haven't met the goal, we're just short of it. We do feel we have made a lot of progress. Again, if you remember that chart that I showed you earlier about the TANF trends, they've really gone down from years ago, and that's because people, in fact, are moving off. The other one that I mentioned earlier was the pregnancy rate for females. And I probably don't have to say females, but anyway, ages 15 through 17, and that's not just in Oregon, that really is around the country. There's been a lot of effort aimed at prevention so that preventing teen pregnancy. We have moved the target, however, so that we don't look like we're trying to get more pregnant over the next couple of years.
Cindy, are there national performance measures such as teen pregnancy that provide national statistics that we can look at to compare Oregon?
Mr. Chair, absolutely. And when each of the clusters comes up, many of them do have national statistics. As a matter of fact, some of the clusters, when you're looking at child welfare programs and vocational rehabilitation programs, there are also federal performance standards that they have to meet, so where they are compared to other states. So as these clusters come up, they will talk to you about those.
Okay, we'll be asking every one of them for how they compare with states in our region and nationally on performance measures, and so if they could be prepared for that and provide that information to
Thanks.
Us, I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm sure that everyone has taken that and they'll be working on that as they go home today.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm just going to skip a little bit. The other one, Key Performance Measure 10, talks about food stamps, and we have a great success story in food stamps in terms of our ability to outreach to get people who need those programs and those services and that benefit to them. The downside of that, I think when Gary and I came back last year to the agency, the good news is we were really doing a lot of outreach. The bad news is we had one of the nation's highest error rates. So I kind of liken that to we type really fast, but we had a lot of mistakes. And so it doesn't make sense if you're giving a lot of these benefits out to people and then making mistakes. So while we got a $2 million bonus from the federal government, we were also facing a significant takeaway if we didn't fix our error rate. And we're very happy to report through the good efforts of Ramona, Jim Neely, and the staff that we have halved our error rate, and we are about at or under the national error rate in terms of food stamps, and they're going to talk about that more. So the good news is we are getting the food stamps to the people who need them, and we are have significantly reduced the error rate in making sure that the right people are getting the right amounts of money. There's going to be a lot of discussion in public health about the teen suicide rate, and we are happy to report that the rate of youth suicide has decreased from 2000 to 2002. As you very well know, Senator Smith has sponsored federal legislation, and it's become quite a significant issue. We are doing a lot of training in that area, and we're trying to significantly impact that rate as we move forward. I know that there's going to be a lot of discussion about child welfare in terms of child protective services, foster care, as well as adoptions. And the next couple of measures deal in the area of child welfare. KPM 13, the median number of months from date of last removal from the home to finalize adoption. I think there's someone said that they thought that we had increased. It took longer for a child to be adopted. I'm happy to report, in fact, that we have not only exceeded the legislative benchmark for the median time, but we have reduced the median, the number of months that it takes to finalize an adoption. That's also one of the areas, even though we have exceeded the benchmark, it's one of the areas that we're going to be looking at in terms of process improvement. One of the things Gary mentioned earlier, we want to get that down even further, to look at ways that we can find adoptions even sooner than we have. There's also a couple of measures that talk about re-abuse rate, and you may ask us, what about abuse rate? Where we get involved in protective services, whether they be for adults or for children, as if abuse has happened, and then where we enter that is to try to make that individual, our purpose, our goal is to make sure that individual, whether it be a child or an adult, is safe. And so what we're looking at, that where our impact is how good was that safety plan, and we want to make sure there's no re-abuse that happens. So the next several measures do deal with the re-abuse rate.
Mr. Chair?
That's
just a comment on that. It was interesting when Healthy Starts started being rolled out, we saw actually an increase in reported cases of child abuse. And so I think we have to keep that in mind, that sometimes the services that we're providing to our families, we're actually able to work with families, but the consequences are we are going to be exposed to many children who are being abused, so our rates will go up because of the interventions that we're trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Excellent point. Thank you. The next measures, I'm just jumping down to measure 17. Again, here's some indicator measures, which is the percentage of low-income women who receive prenatal care in the first 4 months. This is obviously very critical. It's not just this measure, but it's the indicator of the importance of prenatal care and what happens when moms get prenatal care and some of the things that happen when they don't. So this is one of our key indicators for us. Keep performance measure number 18. It jumps to people who complete alcohol and other drug abuse treatment and are not abusing or re-abusing. We have slightly exceeded our goal in 2003. We have a lot of work. We've done a lot of work with evidence-based practices and really spending a lot of time, because we know that alcohol and drug abuse is the gateway, the negative gateway, to a lot of other issues and a lot of other reasons that bring people to the Department of Human Services. We know that if we can stop re-abuse, if we can prevent abuse from happening in terms of alcohol and drugs, that in fact it will significantly impact our caseloads and reduce our caseloads. You're going to hear a lot about methamphetamine. It's a driver for a lot of reasons people come to our doors. In key performance measure number 20, we have had a lot of success in terms of reducing tobacco use among children, adults, and pregnant women. Since the beginning of our tobacco prevention education program, the percentage of adults who smoke has decreased significantly, and we've also, the number of cigarette packs sold per person has also decreased per capita. KPM number 22 speaks to the number of children who are adequately immunized. Again, this is also an indicator measure. Our immunization rate continues to exceed our target, and I think nationally we've also exceeded the target there, and I know that Barry Cass is going to talk to you a lot about that. On number 23, I'm not going to rehash the adults over 65 who received an influenza vaccine. I hope all of you, now that the age has lowered to everybody, that you've all gotten your vaccines.
Oh.
Senator?
I'm going to get my
vaccine.
Are you
leaving yours now? I think I have some needles here for you. We can just give it to you. Okay. One of the areas that is receiving a lot of attention, as it should, is the performance measure number 26, is the reduction of health disparities as measured by the proportion of Oregon Health Plan. We did establish an office in public health looking at this area. We are working with several community groups as well, the Oregon Medical Assistance Program, looking at health disparities, particularly in the areas of chronic disease such as diabetes and asthma. And I know you're going to hear a lot more about that. The next couple deal with percentage, percentage of uninsured Oregonians served by safety net clinics, and that's been a real big issue for us as people are no longer eligible for standard population and the impact that's had on safety net clinics. Barry and Barney will be talking about that. And finally, the percentage of mental health clients who maintain or improve their level of functioning following treatment. We have exceeded our target for the year 2002. There is a time lag in some of this data, and that, so you're going to see different times. But again, we have a huge emphasis on mental health services, and it's been a very big issue for our counties and for the providers and for our local constituents. Any questions?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Masterson.
Thank you. One interesting thing that you haven't put in the goals, but I have seen, at least anecdotally, in the past, DHS has been seen as its own unique silo. Department of Ed has been seen as its own unique silo. And what I'm seeing is, and what I've heard, is that DHS is actually now becoming more involved in the communities and with our local commissions, et cetera. Because when I look at dropout rates isn't the fault of education or families, but it's also how well we serve, how well some of these programs in DHS work. And it's a continuum, as far as I'm concerned, or an integration, I should say. And so that isn't something that's reflected here, but it would be nice if you would just comment, because for some reason there seems to be a slight attitude change in DHS in becoming more of involved in the community, and I don't know.
Mr. Chairman, Senator,
gentler DHS.
Well, I'm glad you gave us a chance to address that, because it's something that relationship is one that I've believed in for nearly a decade now, and I think maybe it is. Maybe people say we're reaching out more, but I have to tell you that 10 years ago, when I visited schools and would talk about, you know, using our caseworkers in schools and outstationing people, there wasn't an interest there.
No.
I mean, I had superintendents and principals say to me, we don't want those people in our building. Those people, meaning my staff, child welfare caseworkers, food stamp people, so on like that. And I don't fault them for that. I mean, they had a view of, you know, they didn't want us intermingling. But over time, and with the passage of things like No Child Left Behind, where the schools are really, I mean, they're really struggling, and the kind of kid, the changes that have occurred in children that are coming into these schools, I think has really served, those circumstances served to bring us together in a very important and meaningful way. I mean, we've had a relationship with the Lincoln County Schools for more than a decade, a really good one. We haven't done a very good job of publicizing it. The same is true in Coos County, and the same is true in Jackson County with our service around our service integration site in Jackson County, the Rogue River service integration site, which actually Senator Winters went down and visited with me one time, and I'd love to have you all see that site. It's a site that was built by the county for us to join the county and the schools and so on. But as you may know, we have what I think is a very exciting project going on in East Multnomah County. primarily because East Multnomah County has changed so much just in the last 5 or 6 years. The demographics out there, the number of low-income families in East Multnomah County, the number of children on free and reduced lunch programs, the number of children that come from migrant families and minority families, a very different population out there. And the schools have actually been wonderful partners for us. You know, I have 5 superintendents that I've met with several times and haven't had an opportunity to do that for a long, long time. And they're coming together with us, and we're planning joint training for this summer for school staff that starts at the secretarial level and the counselor level. The principal contact that parents and kids have frequently in the schools is the secretary for the schools. And the superintendents have said, we need for our staff at that first level to really know who to call, what programs are available, how to get families moving right away. And so we're going to do joint training this summer of our staff. We're going to work to get our people to know each other better and to be able to work with each other better. We're looking at building a website together that will have all kinds of information. It'll be immediately accessible to school people. We're looking at outstationing our staff. We're looking at possibly creating an East Multnomah County center for our human services staff and a facility and so on like that. So I think I really appreciate you bringing it up, because I think there are very exciting things happening. More and more school personnel from other places in Oregon are coming to us about, you know, could we have some of your people stationed in our building? I mean, these are very exciting things. We can provide in those schools, we can provide applications for the CHIP program, for the food stamp programs. We can use the schools as a way to reach out and identify foster families, because we're really trying to focus on neighborhood-based foster care that permits us to, when we have to remove a child, keep the child in that school, not have them leave their friends, leave their teachers, and so on like that. And the schools are a great resource for us to reach out to parents and families who could be foster parents. So this is a very exciting thing, and one that we have to really pursue, and one that has good outcomes for us because we reach the people we need to. It has better outcomes for the schools because they're able to get children to teach that, you know, didn't come to school hungry, didn't sleep in the back of a car, didn't watch dad beat up mom, didn't live in a home where methamphetamine was produced. And those are the circumstances that kids come into school today, and the schools just simply aren't equipped to educate those children. So anyway, thank you for raising it, and it is a high priority for us. So we should probably move on quickly. We're pretty close to being on schedule. We have 2 things we'd like to cover with you yet. One is the priority list, which you'll find is a long folded sheet, and then the reduction list. And I think we can do both of these pretty well in the last 35 minutes here. The priority list is they were in your books. Wait a minute. we have a half an hour. The priority list was a request of us to take the governor's recommended budget and to put it in a priority order, most important to least important. This was an incredibly difficult job for us, and we whined a lot to your staff, to Sheila and John, about how we could ever possibly do this, and we had alternatives for them, none of which seemed to work. So,
I'm out here.
John?
Yeah. We have prioritized lists on the agency website, Gary. Is that right? Is that available? We're not making copies of this.
They'll be there this afternoon. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Okay. So as I said, this was a very difficult exercise for us, and we spent a lot of hours with the cabinet. It's not something that I put together or Cindy put together. We did it with our staff. And it was difficult because with the broad range of responsibilities we have, it's hard to say whether long-term care is the number one thing for us, or child abuse, or mental health, or the state hospital. I mean, you can make arguments for any of those 4 being the most important thing we did. But we tried to follow the recommendations that were given to us to put this together, and those where we were supposed to put them in order as the importance of fulfilling our mandates, What are the long-term implications for programs? How many clients are affected by these programs? What's the return on investment and the results? So we tried to keep that in mind as we put these things together and tried to make them fit so that there'd be some logic to them. But I have to tell you, as you do this, an argument could be made to move these things in a different order by any one of you, I'm sure. We did our best job at trying to do it. And let me tell you what's on the... I'm not going to go through this. There are 73 different items on here in priority order. But so you know what you're looking at. If you start on the left side of the chart, and just if you could start on the first page, left side, top, what we've done is to break this down so you kind of walk down, drill down into the program the way the budget drills down in the program. So the first column where it says department is actually the cluster. So in this very first one, number one, this is a health service cluster program. At the program level, it's the medical assistance program, OHP payments, Oregon Health Plan payments. These are, the next column is another drill down the next level. These are payments for physical health. The next column says these are payments for managed care, fee-for-service, and other client-related adjustments. And then we describe the program. And in this case, we tell you that the payments here are for managed care payments that we make to managed care organizations, and that we have a priority under the statute to, insofar as possible, deliver care through managed care. The payments are secondarily for fee-for-service. And then we list, continuing across, horizontally across, how much money is in this particular priority by fund, general fund. LF is lottery fund, other funds, non-limited other funds, federal funds, non-limited federal funds, and then the total funds that are in this first priority here. Then there's a column for position and FTE. The column that says POP. POP means policy option package. Did we have a package for the governor in this area? It'll say yes or no. And then I think the reduction column is important. This tells you of the reductions, which we'll get to in just a minute, how much of the reduction is related to this priority. So you can see where we took the money for the reductions. And then the citations are Oregon law that requires this program, federal law that may require this program. So you can look through each program and see, gee, is there a mandate under the federal government or under the state government that we have to know about if we want to adjust this program in some way? And then we've also lined up the priorities with performance measures. So Cindy went through the 28 performance measures. If you wanted to say which of this first priority, where does it line up with performance measures, you would know which performance measures to go and look at. And the final column is described as the primary purpose or activity code. This is a code that LFO established. You'll see most of ours are 12. It's a code 12. That's social services code. There are a few that will be code 10, which means health program code. So that's how you read the form, and then I can go through some of it.
Okay, we have a question by Representative Hanna.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Director Weeks, will you help us so that as we go through this in our work groups that we understand, when you see the total fund column,
mm-hmm.
and then you talk of the 10% reduction,
right.
Your 10% reduction is off the governor's recommended budget, not off your total fund column.
Correct.
And as we go through the...
No, we have to do a 10% reduction... of the GRB.
The governor's recommended
budget.
That's
what that column is.
Right. Not necessarily off your total fund line.
No, it's not a 10% of the total fund line and stuff. So.
Okay. And let me follow up. As we go through here, will you have used any other number besides 10% off of that? as others have not taken an across-the-board 10% cut. In that column, did you use the 10% figure all the way?
Hi, Mr. Chair, Representative Hannett. There's a 10% reduction figure for the department's budget, but the 10% doesn't break out across the board against the priorities. In other words, if there's a 10% dollars, but we didn't take 10% of each of the priorities.
Yeah, that's what we're...
So the 10%, and we're going to go through the reductions, and then after this, but the reductions are across the agency's budget, regardless of the priority.
I understand that. So you did take a flat 10% a cut from each of the line items?
No,
we did not. We made selective cuts, Mr. Chairman and Representative Hannon, and you'll be able to see that in the reduction list.
Okay, go ahead and follow up.
Well, I may be getting ahead of
John
Britton's
got.
Well, just maybe if you talked about on the first row, the $277 million, which is under the 10% reduction of GRB.
Right. I can walk you through where that came
from. Yeah, that would be good.
Because we'll go... The $277 million is part of the reduction is actually you'll need to, if you can pull out the 10% reduction list.
Okay, so that's
we can just walk
tab.
You through one example.
Okay,
that's the next tab. So if you have your reduction sheet out. And you look at number two, which is the farthest left column, department priority number two. This is MCO capitation at 72%, where the GRB has at 90. So we're cutting the capitation rate in this reduction option. That cut is reflected in the $277 million. Now, the next thing that's reflected in that is turn your reduction page over to number 15, and you see
small.
Yep,
the 10%.
And you'll see a reduction that speaks to the poverty level for medical adults and children and so on like that. We're dropping the poverty level from 185 to 133%. That cut... is part of the $277 million.
Why did we jump, though? I mean, it's not mine.
Okay, question, John,
trying to understand why it was organized this way. Like, you went from number 1 to number 15, and so how would we know that we would have to look from 1 to 15 to coordinate
We've got a crossover sheet for you to do that. But the reason we had to do that is because we had to cut across fund sources. We had to have a 10% cut for federal, other, and general fund. So in order to do that, things get moved up and down in order to have the totals come out right.
That's what that means.
Following me, we just can't cut across programs. Otherwise, we won't get to a total of 10% federal, 10% general, 10% other. We actually, Mr. Chairman, may have had to cut some programs that were a higher priority for us just in order to get enough money
because
to meet the 10% of the federal fund total that we had to have. It's an awkward exercise. I'm not complaining about it. I'm just saying that it will appear strange for you when you say, well, why you had a top priority here, but you made a big cut in it here. Well, and we have to come back and say, yeah, because the only way we could get to the total federal fund cut or other fund cut was we had to go into this program and cut it.
I understand. It could be a high priority, but the funding level would be a low priority among those items that had federal funds. But it could be a high priority among all priorities or something.
Correct.
I mean, I understand.
Correct.
Mr. Britton.
Just one other comment. I think what you were saying, Mr. Chair, is that just because something is on the high priority on the prioritized list doesn't mean that it's not on the reduction list, and that it might not be prudent to make a reduction in a high priority program.
True. But there's a difference between what DHS has had to do by their requirements of making cuts in each of the categories But one of the goals we're trying to do is, if we're going to make cuts, make them from low overall priorities,
mm-hmm.
because we're not constrained to the same kind of requirements they were in providing the information.
Yes.
So, but I, so I would
right.
hope that we wouldn't be making cuts right. in a higher priority, or else the priority system just fell apart.
Mr. Chair, if I could also mention, the way the budget structure and the way we had to provide this to you, there's a lot of money in those priorities. If you look at the first one, you know, that Gary talked about, you're looking at $2.6 billion. And what we're saying, just because it's our highest priority doesn't mean that there's not a high priority reduction somewhere in the $2.6 billion.
Well, that's certainly right. They have multiple components,
right.
and some of the components
right.
may be much less important than the overall
right.
priority.
Right.
Okay, gotcha.
What gives you, maybe I should have started, Mr. Chairman, at the top of the reduction list, the very top, there's a sort of highlighted area. It shows you what the GRB numbers are and then what our 10% targets were for each kind of fund source. And so that's what had to guide us. We had to get those 10% cuts in each fund source. And it is a bit awkward, you know?
Okay.
So,
Mr. Chair, just one other question. So in your priority one on this document,
the priority list,
yeah. With the 277, is it? I don't have my glasses.
277 million.
Yeah. does that include federal funds? Is that just general fund? When you say 10% reduction, I just need that explained.
That's our total. That's the total fund cut.
Total
so the $277 million, yeah, includes federal, other, could be even lottery, general, right? And then, as I said, Mr. Chairman, we do have a crosswalk document for you if you,
okay.
when you get to the point.
Representative Hanna would like to.
Well, this is tough. And so when you get ready to go to the finding the detail, I would suggest that we have that crossover document soon, because when we go to our work group and we're trying to come up with the number for the
mm-hmm.
for the total of the reduction, to come back to the reduction document and pinpoint each one of those within there without a reference to it is going to be incredibly
yeah.
difficult.
And we'll have that for you, Mr. Chairman, Representative. I mean, I took the crosswalk the other night and actually just wrote the crosswalk on this long document,
okay.
so I wouldn't have to go back and forth, and we can even reproduce this with the crosswalk numbers on it too. So
just
that actually would be,
I would think that would be great, because this would be
okay.
an onerous process to try to navigate back and forth.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman and Representative, we're trying to set this out in the way that we were asked to do it, but make it as clear as possible. And I know it is a tough job to look at it. It wasn't a fun job to put it together. So we'll do our very best to try to give it as much clarity as we can.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
So anyway, I don't want to go through all these because I don't think we have time. Each cluster will come before you with a cluster list like this. So what you have is the entire department, and then when Children and Families begins on Monday, their list will show you what's the priority in within that cluster, and then what are the cuts that relate to that cluster. And we will try to, Representative Hanna, as you suggested, by then have you the crosswalk already printed on here. So,
thank you.
And maybe we should go to, we've already kind of started on the reduction list, but
we'd like to use the next 15 minutes.
Okay, we'll go ahead and finish that. And Cindy, and we've talked about how, she and I talked about how to do this, and we've sort of tried to put all the reductions into buckets rather than walk you through all 45 of them. So I'll let her talk about how we try to bucket these.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what's being handed out to you now is a high-level discussion, a summary discussion of the governor's budget that talks about the investments that the governor has made and also the amounts not included in the budget. And this, again, is the in the budget document you have. The other thing that we'd like to mention in your notebook, if you go to the appendix, we call it the Rainbow Report. But I think it's another part of the context. It's very important before we get to these 10% LFO reductions, as we call them, it's very important that people understand that the department has had significant hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars of reductions since 2001. The way the Rainbow Report, we call it the Rainbow Report because it's in so many pretty colors, but what we've done is by cluster shown all every single reduction since February 1st, 2002, excuse me, that has occurred as a result of special session, emergency board, or regular session. So you can see what has happened. And if you look at the summary page, in 2001-03, you can see in general fund, the department had taken $331 million of reductions. In 03-05, this is just general fund, $571 million of reductions. The governor's budget has over $350 million of amounts not included. And so then we get to the 10% list. So this is on top of everything else, and we think it's really important people understand this is not standalone. This is really additive to all of the hundreds of millions of dollars of cuts. As Gary mentioned earlier, the first page, you can see that in the shading what our quote-unquote targets were. These are 10% cuts over and above the governor's budget. And those cuts really fall into five areas. The first is in the area of administrative costs. You'll see cuts in service and supplies and closing buildings. You'll also see cuts in leveraging dollars through FEOP and other programs. The second bucket, if you will, of reductions is in the area of rates, reducing nursing facility rates, community facility bit rates, regular and special foster care rates. The next area, the next bucket, is delaying startup, where in fact we have one of the reductions is to delay the cost of living increases for providers. Also, they're delaying startup in technology, in our Medicaid management information system, in our state automated child welfare information system. These have also produced reductions. The next area is, and I'm jumping around because we didn't want to go through all of these programs, but I think any of the programs, any of the reductions that you see are in one of these five buckets. In eliminating programs, because at some point you can only reduce so much and you have to start eliminating programs. So it eliminates Staley Agreement, alcohol and drug outpatient programs, student daycare.
I have a question. Like you say, eliminate Staley Agreement. Wouldn't there be judicial consequences to doing that?
Mr. Chair, absolutely.
And so it would be a recommendation that we do that knowing that we would be violating a court order?
Mr. Chair, there are consequences for all of these reductions. Some of them are judicial consequences. Some of them, if they haven't been judicial, there are lawsuits that could develop as a result of them. Some of them are discussions in the past we've had with the federal government. We just didn't feel we had any place else to go. Because if we didn't make these types of cuts here, making the $30 million worth of cuts in Staley we've had to come up with those $30 million to cut someplace else and could easily have touched a lawsuit. So, yes.
Okay.
In eliminating programs, closing Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center, family group homes, and for home care workers, and this would have to be a result of collective bargaining, discontinuing health insurance and workers' compensation. So while it is not a judicial issue, it is a collective bargaining issue. The final bucket is in the area of reducing services, reducing eligibility level for poverty level medical adults, reducing problem gambling services, children's residential treatment, Native American relative foster care, supportive remedial daycare. The one reduction that is in here that's actually already begun is closing the adolescent treatment unit at Oregon State Hospital. So you can you can leave it on the list and say done, or take it off the list. But that, as you know, as a result of a variety of things that kind of came together over the past month, we will be closing that unit at the State Hospital in the next month. So we'll be happy to answer questions. I think the real message is any of these had to be in priority order also. There are no good cuts here. Because of all of the reductions this agency, and more important, our consumers, have taken over the past 3 years, we didn't feel there was any place to go that wasn't going to bump up against either judicial, CMS, federal, and obviously loss of services to our customers. The other important thing that we want to mention is cutting these services doesn't mean these individuals go away. They just show up either in the private sector in emergency rooms, or they're showing up in some other part of our system. We'll be happy to answer questions about these reductions. I think they do speak for themselves, but if you want more information, we'll be happy to provide that to you.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just offer one other thing on this. These were difficult for us to look at. They're going to be difficult for you to look at. We understand that. I think what's really important for us is to be able to give you the best information we can about the consequences of each one of these. So that if you make choices on these, you make choices knowing what the results will be, whether it's lawsuits or lost service and people showing up in other kinds of systems, increasing costs in other kinds of systems. So what we're going to try to do throughout this process is to be as direct as we can to say, if you do this, here's what we believe will happen. And that's not an argument for not doing it. Yeah. It's to try it, because I think that's our obligation to you, is to be as clear as we can about the consequences. And then you, as you're the policymakers, you have to make the choice. But you should know that you're making that choice understanding all the consequences. And we will do our best to do that.
One other thing, sir.
This is tremendously complete. I mean, going back through the history is going to be very helpful, especially for me. And there's a lot of work involved in this, and so I just want to recognize that.
But Mr. Chair,
a lot of effort has gone into that.
Yeah. I have a question. How did you come up with these particular cuts?
Is there criteria, do you mean?
I'm thinking, why are there any, and did you have each agency come up with where they think cut should be, or is this at the macro level? Or
Mr. Chairman, Senator Mullins-Anderson, we within our cabinet, we had each cluster go and try to put together cuts, and then we met as a cabinet. I mean, took several hours, and we looked across the agency at the cuts that were taken by each cluster. And there are consequences for us within the agency. If there's a cut here, it plays out somewhere else. So we try to understand that, and then we put those together in what, as a cabinet, our collective best judgment was on how to take these cuts. I mean, there are no, what people have described in the past as Washington monuments here. You know, you offer something up that you know nobody will ever take and get by that way. We're well past that point. So we did put a lot of thought into this, and I think there are arguments that others could make for a different order. But this is what we came up with as a collective group of those who have to be responsible for these programs. If we have to take these cuts, here's the way we would do it. And it, in a way that we minimize the impact across the, if you can say minimize the impact, but minimize as best we could across the department and across the populations we serve.
And Mr. Chair, if I could also put one last pitch in. A lot of times, people fall to the administrative services cuts because they think they're easy cuts to take. After all, it's just administrative staff. These programs can't exist without infrastructure, and we have whittled away infrastructure over a number of years. So I just caution you as you deliberate to really understand the consequences of some of the administrative services cuts. Although you don't see the direct impact with the individuals we serve, they do provide the infrastructure so that we can have those services happen.
Mr. Chairman, one other thing we can consider that want to say this in response to the Senator's question is, we were trying to look at if some of these were taken, how much could we preserve of the basic foundation of social services? You know, what could we have left to build on in better times? And so we tried to do this in a way that we didn't eliminate programs that were some of the most fundamental to us, and that we would hope we could restore in a better day, in a better time. So we tried to look at that as a factor as well.
I have a question. As I look at recommendations such as the elimination of, you know, 4,000 clients, I don't see a corresponding reduction in staffing. For instance, when we, over the last 2 years, lost 40,000, or actually it's going to be 60,000 members of the standard population, and when I was reading through those figures, I didn't see the corresponding reduction of 98 or 100 or whatever the number would be of claims adjusters. And if it was Blue Cross Blue Shield and they lost a group of 50,000 clients, they wouldn't retain the same staffing structure. You know, there would be correlated responses within the administration arm of it. And so where do those reflect?
Mr. Chair, in fact, when Standard was eliminated last year, we did in fact eliminate a variety, I think over 50 positions, and it wasn't until, and that was part of one of the rebalances that we did. So and then when Standard came back through the provider taxes, we had to come back to the emergency board and ask to restore some of them. So we had eliminated the entire unit.
The whole unit that was for Standard, we did away with at the April e-board. And then when we finally got approval to collect the taxes from the MCOs and the hospitals, we had to come back to the e-board. And we didn't ask for that whole unit back because it was a smaller group. For the very reason that you presented, Mr. Chairman, we asked for a much smaller group to handle the 24,000 that we expected to have. So
do the reductions here, when you're talking about eliminating services, reflect a reduction in administration costs or just benefits that will be saved?
Mr. Chair, they reflect both of those. You'll see. Which one are you referring to specifically?
I just pulled out. I'm looking on page 9 of 38 and just looking at. I mean, it's just an example.
Yeah, it's the whole historical.
I'm in the historical. Well, no, I'm
sorry.
Okay. It doesn't really matter. I'm just talking.
I think the answer is we would expect to be able to show you if we're eliminating a program that we're going to eliminate the staff that relate to that program, Mr. Chairman.
It'll be already included in the numbers.
Yes, Mr. Chair, it is.
Okay. And we should be able to be very specific with you.
Okay, thanks. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the people either in the audience or the listening audience that haven't received this, I think to give you a flavor of what we'll be working on, I'd like to just quote from the first page. While the display is department-wide, each line item identifies the program cluster area, the high-level program level, Orbitz B level, a secondary level beneath this, Orbitz A level, and a further aggregation, if needed, Orbitz A sublevel. The result is 73 different categories. The example below, chart 1, depicts the categorization levels, and in some instances, sub-A categories do not exist, so the A level is used. The second chart displays the breakout to the sub-A level. So I think that clearly explains what we'll be doing.
There was a reason, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, I didn't read those instructions and tried to walk you through it. But, yeah, it's complex.
Written by an Internal Revenue Code technical writer.
Mr. Chairman, we've done what we hope to do in this 2 hours, and we're pretty darn close to your adjournment moment. We thank you for your patience in letting us get through this, and as we said, this is the initial opening. You'll be able to drill down to much more specific questions as we get into the clusters.
Okay, thank you for this information and the willingness to provide us with the subsequent information as we request it. Any final comments or questions? If not, we are adjourned.
I'm pretty excited about getting to the sub-A level.
Well, is that the sub-A level?
We have a place for you, Representative Hanson, in our organization.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.